This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Defying Gravity, the incredible unlikeliness of musical theatre.
So, Jules and I were discussing this before we started, and we're probably going to be bending the only discuss speculative fiction rule. I mean, we've been bending it plenty, but we're going to bend it now on the grounds that, as Jules pointed out, there is no reality where everyone bursts spontaneously into song and dance. So we're just going to say that that's the speculative element.
I mean, yeah, you know, in real life, if someone's going to have their head chopped off, they don't start singing about it along the way, normally.
Well, I mean, accepted.
It's a very final way to, like, prove me wrong, though, isn't it?
Yeah, like, but if I...
A little less extreme.
Well, I mean, like, if I'm ever in the position where I'm going to have my head cut off, I'll just say, you know what? I'm a sing.
Yeah. I'm totally on board with that. In fact, I absolutely love musicals, and I live in the secret hope that one day a spontaneous sort of flash mob type experience will happen around me and everyone will start singing and doing a choreographed dance routine and I'll just get swept up into it. It hasn't happened yet, but, you know, there's the rest of my life yet.
So, I guess the first question to really sort of kickstart this whole conversation is, what's your favourite musical?
That's like asking me what my favourite book is. Let me look at my list. No, it's no good. I could pick up like a favourite half dozen probably. And then I'll go, oh my god, but I love that one as well. That's my favourite too. It's more likely that I'd be able to say I don't like a particular musical for various reasons.
Well, can you name just a few of the ones you like?
Les Miserables, Phantom of the Opera, Wicked, Avenue Q, The Slipper and the Rose, and there's more, definitely.
Okay.
Oh, The Woman in White, though technically that's a libretto.
The what?
The Woman in White.
Oh, right.
Based on the Wilkie Collins novel.
Never seen that one.
Well, I haven't ever actually seen it, although I'd quite like to. I don't think it's been performed at the moment either. Yeah, that's really good. But I'll talk about that a bit later along with some of the others where they've adapted specifically gothic 19th century fiction into musicals. So I think that's an interesting subgenre.
I'm also quite hard-pressed to say what my favourite musicals are. I am definitely a big fan of Les Mis. I really like watching Phantom of the Opera. I've only ever seen it, the film version. I've never actually seen that one on stage. And I've seen Wicked twice, which I've mentioned before. We Will Rock You, which was excellent. And I recently went to see The Book of Mormon, which I believe you've also fairly recently seen as well.
I've been to see Book of Mormon twice.
So that was a good one for you. Well, that's an interesting thing because there's lots of different types of musical. And my brother is not a big fan of musicals, but he has seen a few that he's really, really enjoyed. And he makes an observation that he doesn't really like musicals where the whole story stops in all the song. It's just a lot of repetition. And I can understand that, because musicals like that are very much for people who enjoy musical numbers. So they really appeal to people who like the music aspect of it. And then there are other musicals where the songs themselves are an intrinsic part of the furthering plot. And I think examples of that, or are jokes, basically. So an example of that is Matilda. The Book of Mormon is another excellent example. And I believe Avenue Q. Which you subjected me to some of those songs.
Yeah.
is also an excellent example of music where the songs themselves actually provide something.
I think I'd go, I'm actually sort of with your brother on this one, where he does not like musical at all, full stop, except when he really does, and then he really likes them. And to be fair, someone who spontaneously bursts into song around the house about random stuff, like putting the cutlery away, you'd think he'd like musicals a lot more, but he doesn't, he finds them boring. But, you know, there are certain ones that just get through. He actually mm-hmm. quite enjoyed Wicked. I don't think he'd see it again, but he did quite enjoy it. And obviously yeah. he's seen the Book of Mormon twice, and he enjoyed Avenue Q as well. Now, a lot of that is to do with the humour. And
yeah.
the people who wrote it initially. Interesting, as you say. And the I do think, actually, that musicals really, the songs are actually advancing the plot, as you said. Actually are the really successful ones. The ones that are really getting on board, that there's two kinds actually, are the ones where, as you say, everything stops just to put a song in and it's sort of wedged in, like some of the less well-known Rodgers and Hammerstein ones.
Yeah.
And also Sondheim, you know, a lot of his musicals seem to be, it's like he picks an octave and then never really deviates from it for the entire musical. And that really, really bothers me. Because I like
we're going
variety.
From this C
like
to this C, and that's it.
Yeah,
nothing
that,
else.
That literally is it. But I actually didn't like the musical. I didn't like the whole thing. And mostly it's because it never deviates from that one ruddy octave in the middle.
As a musician, and okay, I've given fair warning that I may spontaneously burst into song because talking about musicals, so, you know, it kind of would be hard not to. There's definitely interesting. It's interesting to watch musicals for the sake of the music. And I do sometimes like just listening to the music, of these performances without actually ever getting to maybe even see the show. One example of that is, Hamilton. Now, have you heard about Hamilton?
I feel like I should have. The name rings a bell, but I don't know what it's about.
Well, it's about, Alexander Hamilton. And it's this huge hit that's been on, it's been on Broadway. I think it's Broadway. It's been out in America. Am I getting things wrong? Because there's the West End and then there's Broadway.
Yeah, the West End's London.
West End is London. Right, got it. Broadway. and it's about the founding fathers, and specifically follows Alexander Hamilton and his relationship with the Lynn... Manual, I'm getting kind of rap, which is a fantastic because the music is totally age inappropriate in style and kind of performance for the story that it's telling, and yet it's an incredibly, you know, powerful and very well received show, and it's interesting because quite often musicals sort of reflect the subject matter and reflect the period or the kind of the element that they're portraying. And this is an example of music and a story which are totally contradicts. It's really interesting. I do recommend giving it a listen to. It's very original, quite unique, and deep, the style of musicals that we're used to. You know, it deviates a lot from the kind of thing that we see from Andrew Lloyd Webber. Unsurprisingly.
Interesting. Okay, I'm going to backtrack a little bit here. What was the first musical you could ever remember seeing, either on, you know, on DVD or film or whatever?
Lord almighty.
The reason I'm asking this is because, really, I think that sort of sets you up for either loving or hating musicals, or whether you get into them a bit later down the line.
Yeah, I think possibly... It might have been one of the big ones that sort of sticks in my mind is We Will Rock You. But I would never really consider that it was a musical, but I wouldn't consider it as a musical in the same sense because I was already familiar with the songs from Queen.
I can't believe you've named that when I think of that as quite a recent musical.
No, is it like...
Look, just over there, there's the edge of the generation gap again.
Oh, it's I'm just trying to think of sort of, because I came into musicals quite late, and I think another probably one of the first musicals that I saw on stage, that was a proper established musical and not just, you know, a play with music in it, was probably Wicked. Though I had seen like school performances of things like, I think a musical version of The Wind in the Willows, and Guys and Dolls as well.
Yes. See, almost all the Disney films have musical elements.
Yeah.
But I was about 9 years old, and it was a friend's birthday treat, and we all got taken out to the Vic in Bournemouth to see Joseph and his Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Oh, goodness me!
Also, I mean, I was so ill. I was just coming down with this really, really nasty cold, and I was running a temperature, and I was just feeling really awful. But I was trying not to make a fuss because I was at a friend's house. All the girls were messing around and getting told off by my friend's mum, but I wasn't. I was being really quiet because I really wanted to go and see this. I just remember she sat me on the end of the row because she was worried that she might have to take me out because I was obviously quite ill and was throwing a fever and what have you. It was really funny. I sat there just avidly watching this thing. There's this part where Joseph's 11 other brothers go running up the aisle, and as they ran up, as one ran up past me, God, I can't even remember, it was Reuben. It was the one playing Reuben. That's how well this is stuck in my mind. As he ran past, he saw me sat on the end and he ruffled my hair. So for a moment, it was like I'd been pulled into the musical just because I'd been acknowledged. So it just completely made everything worth it. It made the fact that I was feeling really rough, really awful.
Aww. That's so lovely.
And I'm sure part of it is just the whole sort of really fond memory sort of linking the two things together. But I do remember just being absolutely enthralled by this very, what for me was a very familiar biblical story. By that point, I'd read the Bible from beginning to end. And I don't mean the children's Bible, I mean the really graphic one. And it was just like seeing it really brought to life like this. Obviously it didn't happen that way, if it happened at all, but it, you know, it sort of clicked the whole music and theatre and story all together for me.
Now, you see, you've reminded me that actually the first musical I ever encountered wasn't one that I watched, it was one that I was in. And that was Joseph and his Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Many female parts in that musical.
No, but I was just part of the chorus. I was part of the chorus. It was put. They brought in a children's chorus to sort of add things to certain songs, and I was part of it. I do love musicals, and I know exactly what you mean about this desire that life might get a musical number at some point, that life might be musical. And I did want to write a play at one point, like just a spoof play about a whole town which gets cursed.
Yeah.
And they start, everyone starts singing and dancing and they can't stop. As in every time something vaguely exciting happens or an exclamation is made, there's a whole dance number and they're all getting exhausted at this point. They're like, oh God, we need to stop this because we're just all going to speak to the witch who cast the spell. And it's just this whole musical adventure. And then at the end, it's revealed that the curse was only supposed to last for a day. So actually, the curse was lifted after sunrise, but they were all just kept doing it because they kind of secretly wanted to. And then at the end, they're like, oh, all right, well, let's have one more dance number. And they they just do it. And I think actually the weird popularity of gosh, I wish things were a musical, has been shown that you often, in long-running series, you almost always have a musical episode in something where it's musical. Even when it's not speculative fiction as a musical, they had a musical episode of Buffy. They managed to do that. Yeah, yes, Buffy probably was the one that started it off. And
they did it in Supernatural as well, haven't they?
They did it vaguely in Supernatural, yeah. In a way that was kind of a shame, considering we didn't actually get to see him really singing, which was a shame. But you know, they did do it in Supernatural, and I'm trying to think of what other series where they've had a musical episode. There are others.
There are. It's become a bit of a thing. They sort of did it a little bit in How I Met Your Mother and things like that as well.
Yeah. And then you get musicals which are like Dr. Horrible, and then you have musicals which are really not nice at all. And some examples of that are, you would never have expected the demon of Sweeney Todd does not seem.
No, I mean, it doesn't, but, and also, Hyde, Dr. Jekyll and
Yeah.
Mr. Hyde,
Yeah, these don't seem like
the same.
appropriate stories to be musicals, and yet.
Yes, and yeah, I think that's the thing, though, with musicals, because it can make a very, very unpalatable and unlovely subject that much easier to look at. For example, the Book of Mormon, which looks at the horrific conditions in Africa and things like female genital mutilation and the fact that you have an entire religion there that's telling gay people to reprogram themselves basically and said, well, there is some positive about this and this religion and the fact that everything is so hopeless. And it generally does it in such a way that it's like, we're not telling you that this is good, but we are, so let's look at the entire thing. And it does make it more accessible in that respect than it does it with humor.
Yeah, the Book of Mormon. I had an interesting relationship with it because it was obviously very funny the whole way through. But I started to get really uncomfortable. And at the end, you know, my brother and my father and everyone else, that they had all really enjoyed it, and I just felt really uncomfortable. And my father was just there, like, you know, was it? Did you, was it because you were offended? And I was there, like, no, it wasn't actually because I was offended. It was because I actually got stuck on the subject matter that was beneath all of the jokes. And the thing that did it, oddly enough, the thing that did it was one of the funniest aspects, which was the creepy Mormon hell dream.
Which is just like my favorite scene almost.
Yeah, it's this idea that they all have the creepy Mormon hell dream where they do something, you know, if they've done something wrong, they dream they go to hell. And that, like, I was laughing, and then it really struck something with me because I got really freaked out. And I remembered a time in my life when I was little, and if I did something wrong, or well, what I perceived to be wrong, but was actually, you know, not really wrong at all. And then I got sick. I used to believe I was genuinely being punished by God. Like, this is punishment, and I deserve this. I deserve this because I thought a girl was pretty in a way that wasn't just complimentary, you know. I thought I was being punished for my sexuality. And so it kind of really struck me, and I suddenly went, oh God, I've just remembered that that's an actual thing in the world, and that there are other people who are genuinely going through this.
And they still feel like that. You expect that lightning bolt and to be managed to get away from it, don't you?
Yeah, and the thing is, like, I don't think we ever truly get away from it.
No, it is a form of conditioning, and
Yeah.
it is one of the least savoury aspects of religion because on one hand you've got, if you like, the Catholic guilt or the Mormon guilt in this respect, and on the other hand you've got people being conditioned to think anybody else is infidels. So, you know, it's an important thing that they shone a light on there.
Yeah.
But you're right, it is, you know, when you look at it directly like that, without the protective layer of the jokes and the songs and the funniness, it is really uncomfortable to look at
It's
and to experience it.
super uncomfortable.
And one of the things I loved about the Book of Mormon was, yeah, they're highlighting the ridiculousness of organized religion and not really picking on being Mormon, I don't think. It's just that's the subject matter.
Yeah.
And you've got things like, well, we'll look at the belief system. And you've got the guy with sort of, oh no, well, I've got everything written down on this book of gold, but I've buried it in the garden under a tree. And then someone else digs it up 200 years later. And it's like, to keep it safe, I'll bury it somewhere else. And
Yep.
then you've got the guy there going, actually, God, if I do this, then no one's going to know. They're just going to have to believe what I say. And God's like, yeah, this is what I'm going for. It's really, really funny.
I am Jesus Christ. Yeah, it was a very good musical, and the songs were catchy. Interestingly enough, I found that the songs were catchy lyrically, but musically they weren't. in that musically they sounded incredibly generic, which I think, I mean, was probably part of it, in that it was actually a serious story that was disguised as something innocent, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think, and obviously it made, you know, having the songs be a bit more generic made it accessible to a wider group of people.
Yeah. So musically, it wasn't actually it was catchy because it was simple, but it wasn't actually that interesting. You know, it was definitely, when I compare it again with what I've heard of Hamilton, that's two completely different kinds of musicals. So people who kind of throw musicals into the same pot and say they're all the same really have not encountered musicals properly, because they're very, very different.
Definitely. I mean, if you could mix up Andrew Lloyd Webber and Sondheim, for example, then definitely.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think you could listen to a song from either one of those two particular authors and think, oh yeah, they sound the same. Even if you didn't know who you were listening to, you'd be able to tell they were definitely by different authors.
Yeah.
In my opinion. And that this is somebody who doesn't read music. But going back to what I was saying, yeah, music makes difficult concepts more palatable.
Yeah.
I think. And I think also you can have very nasty stories or stories that are really very uncomfortable. And again, you can almost say things with music that you can't say with a straight, or rather you can say them in, say, a straight play format, but you wouldn't appeal to as many people. And if what you're trying to do is, for example, like the Book of Mormon, get a message out that the important thing is hope, treating people decently at the end of the day.
Yeah.
You're going to appeal to a much broader audience if you can do it in a way that everyone can digest. That being said, people who really, really can't stand swearing in any kind of storytelling probably aren't going to get on with the Book of Mormon or with Avenue Q, written by the same people.
Yeah.
Because of the excessive amounts of swearing. Not pull their punches, but.
Yeah. One of my all-time, you know, favourite musicals that always kind of actually pulls on the heartstrings is West Side Story.
Yeah, I like that one.
Which is obviously a play on Romeo and Juliet, but is also looking at, you know, into local. Yeah, it's a story. It is essentially a bit of a story about racism, and it's a story about internal conflict in certain boroughs and stuff like that, gang violence. And, you know, separation. And the songs are really joyful.
Yeah.
They're all really, really joyful. There are some incredibly catchy songs. I mean, In America is a fantastic song. It's a song which has got all, people recognize the songs from West Side Story. And then its ending. Just,
yeah, it
is brutal. And I think what happens is that you kind of go through the story on a bit of a cloud. And yet, as it comes to the ending, one woman almost gets raped. Or she gets assaulted in some way.
Yeah.
The ending, the music just stops. And it's almost like the music is a kind of a metaphor for the falling in love, for the strong emotions.
Yeah, and then everything's ended, and you're just left there with Maria holding the empty gun, saying, are you happy? This is what you've got. This is where this has brought us all. Is there not one bullet left for me? Because obviously it's a take on Romeo and Juliet, but I think in some ways it's so much more poignant than Romeo and Juliet is.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think it's more poignant actually because Maria lives. And I think it's also more poignant because the love is almost a little bit more believable.
Well, yes, there is that.
It's an incredibly beautiful story and it's a fantastic musical. And I think the visual aspects, people laugh about the whole clicking thing.
It's funny, but also, does it not also sort of denote that when you've got, it doesn't matter who's who, it doesn't matter if you're a shark or a jet, if you're one or the other, you belong to them. So you belong somewhere in a place where you will largely feel disenfranchised because you're not part of that culture, you're not embedded.
Yeah. No, musicals, bringing in the aspect of music to a story, is, I think, something which is not new to storytelling in the least. And I think that its reintroduction into the telling of stories is incredibly important. When one thinks that originally stories were told through song or told with song.
Yeah. And in part that was to make them easier to remember, because if you're a bard and you have massive paeons of stuff and written language, then setting them to music actually makes them a lot easier to remember.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But I think it also increases the impact of what's being said.
Yes, I think that's exactly that. And music can act as a shortcut to communicating emotion.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is true. Yeah, because it builds up an emotion. I'm trying to think if we took the lyrics of certain songs and just had them as words, then they wouldn't have nearly as much impact.
No. I mean, it just reminds me of that Hindu legend of, I think it's Krishna gives the seven heavenly notes to mankind, which is obviously not quite an octave. But the whole point is each one corresponds to a chakra, so it will affect that part of the human spirit and elicit that sort of emotion from them. And
played
correctly, you can, playing the seven heavenly notes like that, you can actually basically control mankind and steer them towards great kindness or great cruelty or what have you.
Yeah, which I don't think is, you can understand where the process for that thought or that idea came from. Because music is incredibly emotive, and I think that music and smell are two of the biggest, can have the biggest sort of response, can cause the biggest emotional response.
They are directly linked to the memory centers of the brain as well.
Yeah. So it's, I'm very fond of musicals, and I think that they can have huge impact into stories.
Okay, going back to something I was saying earlier. Now, obviously, I'm a massive fan of 19th century literature, but not everybody is for some reason. Can't think why. Some people find it quite dry and prosy and perhaps even a little overwritten and too descriptive. Which is totally not. 19th century literature is brilliant. But it's very noticeable that it has some great stories that have adapted really well to musicals. So we've got a musical Jane Eyre. We have a musical Wuthering Heights. In fact, we've got two musical Wuthering Heights that I can think of.
And a famous song.
And a famous song. And there's obviously, you're talking about Kate Bush.
Maybe.
There's The Woman in White, as I mentioned earlier. Again, more Gothic literature. I don't think there's a musical Dracula, but I'm willing to be wrong. There's obviously a musical Sweeney Todd, which is from an old Penny Dreadful. Not really literature, but still there. There's Hyde, Jekyll and Hyde. Phantom of the Opera. There's The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which started off as a French musical, which I've seen the French version done, and actually it's completely different to how we do it in Britain. I think there's far less moving around for a start.
The French don't believe in,
exertion.
Effort. Exertion, yeah. No. Why do the waving of the arm just stand there, be emotional? I can say that because I'm French.
But there's a lot more. But, I mean, the same musical sung in English, I wouldn't say there's a complete difference in the way it feels, because I'd say the music in French is still very evocative. It's just, more like when they do the English version, or when they have done it, it feels like you're being made to, you're actually watching an actual play.
Yeah.
And whereas the French one, it's more like you're attending a concert. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
So anyway, there's loads of examples of basically Gothic literature that's been turned into musicals, and my theory is that somehow, and obviously there's Les Misérables, which I completely skipped over, but that is 19th century literature as well. And I love that book. That's one of my favourite books of all time. But when I say that I actually enjoy reading it, and I've read it several times in both French and English, people just look at me really strangely, like, why would you read that for fun?
It is a bit of a tome.
Well, yes.
And you read it in French?
Yeah, I did. It did take me quite a lot longer in French, in fairness. And I don't think my French is good enough now for me to be able to read it. I've got incredibly rusty.
I respect, Jules. Even I wouldn't read it in French. I don't think even my mother would have read it in French.
This was back in my 20s when I thought, I want to see if there's any real difference in translation. I've read Goethe in the original German as well. But...
Okay.
That's just me being a bit of a word nerd, so ignore that bit. My theory is that music can actually make the classics, which people find difficult because of the way they're written, and they were written in such a way as to be read aloud, so that they were performed as almost, you know, they didn't have televisions, so someone reading aloud was entertainment. Two or three people together. It makes it a lot more accessible in general when you have, and you have great stories.
Do you know what I think? I think that musicals are modern operas.
Yes, I'd agree with that.
And when I say that, people get very, a few people have gotten very upset with me. But if you look at operas, the music in opera has changed over time to reflect the music tastes of the era. And that's exactly the same for musicals. So I do thoroughly believe, the problem is that, you know, opera has become so ingrained as something different. You know, you wouldn't, someone who goes to an opera might not necessarily want to go and see the Book of Mormon, you know. Oh, I do fancy a bit of Dido and Aeneas. Great. Let's go see the Book of Mormon is probably not something that anyone has ever suggested ever. but that again is about a taste in music. Not actually anything to do with the form of opera. Because I think that you can have opera which is very acted, or you can have opera where they really don't move around very much at all. And so, and the form of musicals has changed. And I believe I mentioned this on an earlier episode. If you listen to the original recordings, some of the original recordings of some of the early sort of French versions of Les Mis, they've got synths. It's really rocky. It's very pop, kind of almost disco. It's not at all dramatic, which is what you'd expect.
Yeah. I found that with the French version of Notre Dame as well. It wasn't that they had synths. They had all this sort of Spanish guitar in the background. So it's like, well, I can kind of see what you're going for there, but this is a lot cheerfuler than I'm expecting this story to actually play out.
Yeah, so I think that just goes to show that musicals will reflect the music of the era. And that's exactly the same for operas during the time that they were being produced, because of course they were going to reflect what was popular at the time.
Yeah.
So musicals are modern operas. And maybe in a few thousand years' time, people will look at our current musicals and say that they are operas. But and people say, oh no, musicals now are too rude, they're too raunchy, and I'm like, I'm sorry, Carmen, and gosh, what's the other one that I'm thinking of, which is very raunchy. There's several which are raunchy. Don Giovanni.
Yes.
It's about a serial adulterer who's just passing through places. Like
and that is actually quite funny, that one as well.
Yeah, until the ending. I actually saw, and this is an interesting one. I'm quite a fan of a theatre group called Knee High Theatre.
Yeah.
And they did and they often incorporate music into their performances, and I wouldn't say that they're musicals, but they do sort of come on close, because they do have these sort of musical numbers sometimes. And Don John had a lot of kind of musical and almost dance numbers a few times as well, or very sort of physical scenes. And it was It was a modern adaptation of Don Giovanni called Don John, with an actor called Gisleorn Gardason, who was very, very good looking. I think I think it was the first time in my life, the first time in my life I ever looked at a man and thought, that is a very good looking man. I would not mind him. Like, you could totally understand why all these women were falling in love with him on stage. I was there like, yep, me too, my friend, me too. And it was a fantastic performance. And they incorporated music into it, and had several songs, and I've got the soundtrack. I bought it on the spot because it was just amazing. And that was an interesting idea, was that it was an adaptation of an opera set with modern music. So it was itself just a modern opera adaptation of an old opera. And it was incredible. A really fantastic, very emotional performance that I've never forgotten.
I mean, actually, I do like opera, and mostly it's because all the ones that I've ever seen are so completely bonkers that I actually do count as speculative fiction.
Yeah.
There's always something really bizarre going on somewhere. If you take the Magic Flute, for example, does anyone really know why all those characters are thrown together, really, at the end of it all? It's all totally weird.
It's a very, yeah, but, you know, Mozart was a weird guy.
Well, yeah, and the Marriage of Figaro and things like that. And,
yeah.
But they somehow they work.
They do. I was actually in a the other thing is there's something about being in a musical, being in a performance like that, where you actually really get into it. And I was in a performance of Dido and Aeneas, an amateur performance, at school. And I was one of the witches who, if you've ever listened to Dido and Aeneas, the witches have got these great little kind of exchanges where most of the song is them laughing.
Yeah.
It's just ha 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 the whole way through. And I was doing that with a very good friend of mine, Katie. And so we were witch one and witch two, or as the conductor was calling us, bitch one and bitch two. I there was a lot of enjoyment because our songs were basically laughter. We were pretty much giggling the whole way through, and we were talking about how, yeah, we're going to really screw Dido over. We're going to do all this awful thing and separate her and Aeneas, and it's going to be great. And then, you know, having done that and me feeling very pleased with myself, or like feeling unjustifiably pleased when I watched the rest of the play unfold, I was like, yes, ha, 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 it's all going according to plan. And then Dido would sing Dido's Lament, which is one of the most emotional pieces ever. And I would cry every time. I feel guilty. I genuinely would feel guilty, like, oh dear. I did a bad thing. And opera is not boring. It's anything but boring. And I think that there's a pomposity which is attached to it, which actually disregards the kind of humour that was going on in the day. In the same way that, you know, pomposity is attached to Shakespeare. Which is, as we have established, 90% puns and dick jokes.
Yeah.
And I think musicals, in that sense, actually teach us something about operas. And that we need to appreciate operas are funny. There's lots of very funny things, especially in Mozart's stuff.
Yeah.
He was incredibly immature as a person. He was, you know, this was not someone who was very solemn. He was not a solemn person at all.
Part of it, to go off on a tangent, is Mozart's upbringing, and it was a kind of almost child abuse the way he was sort of paraded all around the continent, showing off his child prodigy status, and it really screwed him up. But it also left him as this sort of child man who wrote some really peculiar but also fantastic stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he was basically a performing monkey. I mean, let's not lie. But yeah, I do thoroughly feel that musicals are the modern operas.
Yeah. Let's look at some specific things. And before we do that, I'm just going to have a quick whinge, if you like, about Rodgers and Hammerstein, who probably yeah. produced some of the most famous musicals that, you know, might have missed you, in fairness, but certainly I grew up with them sort of in the background, as it were.
Yeah.
They've been produced. I mean, it seems like My Fair Lady and Carousel, Guys and Dolls, The Sound yeah. of Music, Kiss Me, Kate, Calamity Jane, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. There's a whole, like, plethora of them. And it's only going back and watching them as an adult, not My Fair Lady so much, because obviously that was based on Pygmalion. But things like Carousel and being utterly horrified by Message. And you realise that Rodgers and Hammerstein is not this perky, happy, cheerful little sort of musical setup where they sing perky little show tunes. It actually deals with some really dark and nasty stuff, like the domestic abuse in Carousel. Come just take a moment to address that. There's the entire like verse of a song where she's saying, well, sometimes someone hits you because they love you. And she's singing it to her daughter.
That's...
yeah. And I probably would have enjoyed Kiss Me, Kate, which is a version of The Taming of the Shrew, which is a Shakespeare play I really like.
Yeah. Really?
Yep.
Ah,
I probably would have liked that a lot more if I'd seen it as a child, for example, because I wouldn't have got the massively sexist undertones. In fact, they're not really even undertones in Kiss Me, Kate. And I just ended up turning it off halfway through because I was just like, I can't watch this anymore. I genuinely cannot watch the whole thing.
That's very interesting. Yeah. But I think there's an element of the fact that they're also tainted a little bit by time.
Yeah, some of it's
era.
But I can't help but feel that Rodgers and Hammerstein actually were looking at it very cynically. And this isn't them forwarding their own agenda as such. This is them saying, we can make a song about it and you'll love it anyway, but we think this is fucked up shit, basically.
Yeah.
But, you know, you laugh and enjoy it because we're singing about it. Because even Calamity Jane, which arguably has one of the more dynamic female leads, she still ends up capitulating at the end with the whole, well, it's woman's thinking, so I'll just go with the man who wants me after all.
Oh, wow, okay.
It's really quite depressing. I mean, there's a beautiful bit at the end where she's getting into the carriage with her new husband, and he says, hang on a minute, what have you got tucked into your garter? And it's a gun. And she said, it's in case any more actresses blow in from Chicago. But...
yeah, that is rather depressing.
So anyway, that's my Rodgers and Hammerstein rant over.
No, that's fair enough. And again, it highlights this. The fact that actually music can be one of the best mediums to talk about some of the hardest top subjects.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mentioned, didn't I, that my dad was in Guys and Dolls recently.
Oh, yes, you did. How was that?
It was really good. It was really awesome. Probably one of the best performances I've seen of it. And that's saying that that's me haven't actually been in a performance of Guys and Dolls. My dad had one of the lead roles this time, or one of the supporting lead roles anyway. And obviously he was really good. But what struck me about it this time, looking at it a bit more in depth and from a distance of quite a few years, was the fact that while there's a lot of dark stuff there, there is, I mean, it really is exploring the relationship between men and women, and yeah. also between right and wrong, or perceived right and perceived wrong, and being true to your own moral compass. There's a lot of good stuff in there. And one thing that I do really appreciate now is the fact that didn't matter the fact that Sky Masterton ended up getting Sarah Brown really ridiculously drunk, he still respected the fact that she was not in a state to give consent and took her home. So, yes.
Yeah.
It's not always about... And that's one where, obviously, they deal with some quite dark subjects. And it's not, it's a case of setting your character right. It's like, he's a decent person. He might be a gambler. He might be a shyster. And he might not really be looking to settle down with anyone. But at the same time, he's a decent person. He wouldn't necessarily mm-hmm. just take advantage. So,
which is actually something that brings us on to another topic, which is how actually musicals can because of the nature of them, can actually glorify characters who don't actually deserve to be glorified. Well, and in particular, I'm thinking of the Phantom from Phantom of the Opera.
Do you know, I was thinking that. And let's be honest, there is a small, perhaps it's not very small, coterie of women who find it the most romantic thing in the world to have this idea of this man stalking them and willing to kill for them. And maybe for 5 seconds, that might actually be true, but this is about someone's obsessive love for someone that you can never love them back. And not because they're deformed, but because there's something really deeply wrong with them inside.
And it's, I think the problem is that he has some great songs.
He does, and he is portrayed as this dark, Byronic, brooding hero, but at the same time, it's like, how many people does he kill in the first act?
So many.
And by the end
so
of it,
many people.
By the end, he's burnt down the entire Blinking Theatre. He's willing to kill her fiancé in front of her, rather than let her go with, you know, right up until the point where she undoes him, as it were.
Yeah. Dude, you need to chill. Oh, okay.
I think what gets me about, and I love Phantom of the Opera, I really do, but at the same time, what really bothers me is that it ended in the right place. It ended in the place the book ended, where the Phantom gives up his obsession because her happiness matters to him more. So it shows he's a redeemable character, even if he then goes and dies or whatever. Because there's still something there, despite the fact that he's a murderer, despite the fact that he's a stalker, and despite the fact that he's not very successful attempted rapist. And then Andrew Lloyd Webber, in a complete moment of fantasy, wrote Love Never Dies, which is the sequel to Phantom of the Opera, which basically undoes everything good about the ending of the first musical.
Yeah. Which I never really got. I haven't seen it, and to be honest, I never really wanted to. It just felt to me like it ruined something which it had spent so long establishing.
Yeah. I did watch it, and if you just look at it as a musical, it's not that terrible. I've definitely seen worse musicals, but if you look at it in the context of what a tour de force Phantom of the Opera was, it's appalling. Mm-hmm. It's really, really bad. Because you've got, you know, Raoul suddenly this drunk gambler who's got rid of all his fortune, and he's sending his wife back on the stage to earn money, which he's then gambling away. And they've got a child, apparently, except that it's not his child, and it turns out that Christine had second thoughts after she got married. Oh, and the Phantom's back. That's what I mean, it's complete fantasy, and not in a good way, not in a good way, instead of a speculative fiction type thing. This smacks very much of someone who lets someone get away, or let the right one go, and this is them fantasizing about them coming back, and everything coming out. Which, if you know the history of the actual musical Phantom of the Opera, it's not difficult to draw parallels, shall we say.
Yeah. So this is where musicals can actually do some harm.
Theoretically, yeah, definitely. If you look at things like Jesus Christ Superstar, you've got King Herod in that singing one of the jazziest numbers ever. He's like a pretty, pretty cool guy. He seems like the guy who's standing up against future organised religion at one point. It's like, no, what you're actually doing is you're questioning someone, ready to torture them, and then crucify them. Can we look at this straight on?
Well, when you put it like that...
What's the line? Come on, Jesus, let's be cool, walk across my swimming pool. it's a brilliant song. It's hilariously funny. And, you know, it's very tongue-in-cheek, but it would be easy to take it in a different way.
Yeah, that's sorry. I've never actually seen that with Jesus Christ Superstar.
It's pretty good. It's very 70s, but it is pretty good.
Yeah, like I've heard some of the music, but I've never actually seen it. And again, it's an interesting one. And I think it deals with a topic which I think a lot of people are worried about dealing with, and because it's a musical, it can get away with it.
Yeah.
Again, musicals, for some reason, can get away with stuff that plays without music can't, possibly because musicals are written off, and they're conscious of the fact that they're written off.
I mean, what's interesting about Jesus Christ Superstar is the fact that he does not come across as the main character in that musical. He comes across as the character that the musical's about, but mm-hmm. not the main character. And when you do see him and you do have him singing his own arias, basically he's this very conflicted, tormented person who doesn't know whether he's doing the right thing or not.
Yeah.
Which might explain why, you know, it got slammed by certain communities.
Yeah, I can understand.
Yeah, I mean, it did fall, I mean, at least it put Mary Magdalene in it, but it did fall into the trap of making her a prostitute. Which, you know, there's a fairly significant body of evidence that the historical figure probably was not a prostitute.
Yeah, probably not.
Probably not. But they weren't quite ready to go Holy Blood, Holy Grail, so... See, that would be an interesting musical. Holy Blood, Holy Grail, the musical.
I...
People are going to throw rocks at me, aren't they?
They're going to come for you, Jules.
Moving swiftly on. Looking at another one which looks at religion, Fiddler on the Roof.
Again, haven't seen it.
Just a brief bit. It's largely about three sisters looking for advantageous marriages. They're part of a strict ascetic Jewish community. And mm-hmm. the entire musical is really about this dying Jewish way of life. And it's quite poignant. I mean, A Fiddler on the Roof is kind of their storyteller, if you like. The one who keeps the traditions alive in the community. And all three sisters, it starts off really, really chirpy and cheerful, and as you go on, it gets darker and darker and darker. Each sister faces a slightly different trial, and it's until you get to the youngest sister, and she falls in love with a Gentile, so her family exiles her.
Wow. That's
It's not
harsh.
What you think of as musical fodder, really.
No. But again... Yeah. Goodness me, Jules.
But I think it manages quite an introspective look at an enclosed, religious-centric community like that in a way that perhaps other things would not be able to.
If they'd only set it to song. Yeah. No, it's true. And I'm trying to think of other plays, I mean, other musicals. Rent as well has got some very dark. I haven't seen it, but I've been informed that it's got some quite diverse characters, but it deals with some pretty intense themes.
Chess, actually.
Chess, yes. Now that's one that's
all about the Cold War, essentially. I mean, it's about chess, but it is about the Cold War. The whole chess thing is. It's just a metaphor for the Cold War state between Russia and America and Britain, etc.
Yeah.
And you get to the very end of it, and you still don't know whether her father's alive or dead. Apparently the KGB are releasing him, but are they releasing his body? Are they releasing him alive? So again, pretty dark stuff.
Yeah. So then, this image of musicals as these joyful, very... uplifting, very sweet and easy watching things is really challenge. Yeah. Because I don't think I've ever really watched a musical which hasn't actually been about something a lot deeper.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you can look at it from a surface level, or you can look at, you know, as you peel back the layers, you realise that actually it is dealing with some really quite deep stuff. And some really quite emotive topics.
Yeah.
I mean, if you take Evita, which is not a favourite musical, but I think is one of the best portrayals I've ever seen of a female anti-hero, you know, climbing to the top of her game and still ultimately failing as a person. And yet it sort of turns her into a martyr, although she's really quite a dreadful person.
Yeah.
And it's the story of Ava Perón and, she dies before she manages to become vice president of Argentina. But what she does to get there, you know, talk about ambition trampling over the smaller people.
Yeah, so not a happy story. Okay, well, I think we're going to have to call it. But before we do,
yeah.
Jules, I'd like you to name what's a song from a musical that you often find yourself humming or singing.
No Good Deed from Wicked.
Yeah, it's. I mean, everyone always talks about Defying Gravity, but No Good Deed is also one of my absolute favourites.
It's between those two. I mean, I could be found singing from almost any of them, but I mean, Susan Boyle kind of put me off I Dreamed a Dream.
I haven't heard her version, so.
I think it's just because it got overplayed.
Yeah, I think I managed to hide from it.
Well done.
So, yeah.
But yeah, No Good Deed.
No Good Deed is an incredibly powerful one, and I think Defying Gravity is also another one which people just can't help but flock to.
No, and they're both at extreme turning points in the character arc, which is why they work so well.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, we were talking about examples of the song. Those scenes would not be poignant if those were just spoken words. Defying Gravity wouldn't be quite as powerful if she just said those words. The song is what gave that whole scene, you know, really something.
Yeah.
So, and okay, I'm trying to think what song I often do. I think, yeah, quite obvious to you is that I tend to sort of go to Wicked. But I think possibly because I have been listening to the Hamilton soundtrack, there's a song called Burn. In it, which plays around in my head a lot. It's very gentle. It starts off gentle, and then actually kind of really builds up to something. So I often hum that one. I definitely recommend listening to it. And I think I Dreamed a Dream. I probably do end up singing that quite a lot. But I think actually, and if we're putting operas and musicals into the same pile. I think probably the song I end up singing the absolute most is the Habanera or the Habanera from Carmen in French. The L'amour est un oiseau rebelle que nous ne peut apprivoiser. That one. The one that's in Aristocats. Which only, it's weird, whenever I sing that, people are like, oh, I've heard that before, and I'm like, Aristocats, and they're like, Aristocats! For some reason, that's where everyone knows it from. So yeah, I think that's probably the one I fall to very often, because it's a great, fantastic, and highly addictive song.
Yeah, this has just made me want to go and watch musicals.
Excellent! Go watch a bunch of musicals. We'll do that. So what are our listeners' favourite musicals? Do you agree, disagree with anything we've said? What are the earworms from musicals that won't get out of your head? And have you ever just seen a musical which has had no depth at all to it? Be sure to send us your thoughts. And until next week, bye-bye.
Thanks, bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.